My deep appreciation of theater history was instilled in me by Tom Empey, a college mentor to me and hundreds of others. While teaching Greek theater terms, he would grab the fabric of his slacks and say, "You see these pants? Euripides, Eumenides," making light of content that could be considered rather dry and stuffy while still maintaining respect for the art, which is what I want to do with this podcast. For each episode, I invite a guest from the many paths my theater career has taken me down. I give my guest no idea what we'll be talking about, but they know we're going to find an outrageous story about theater history and perhaps get a better understanding about why we're still doing it after all these years. So welcome to Euripides Eumenides, and I am your host, Aaron Odom. Apocalypse, I said, why you wanna show up now? Just when the heart of my life was getting good. I'll give you one more chance. Walk on out of the door, yeah. Get your ass to getting where the getting is good. Good morrow, Eumenidites. This is Aaron Odom from Trident Theater back again with a new episode of Euripides Eumenides, a theater history podcast. It's been quite the busy time for Trident these last several weeks. Besides coordinating all the interviews over the last two episodes about Rocky Horror Picture Show Fall 2023, I've been teaching a class for senior citizens in my community about the process of directing a play. I'm also currently the president of our local community theater board, and beyond getting a production ready to open this week on the business side of things, we're in the midst of several improvement projects for our theater and getting the slate of shows for the next season all lined up. Perhaps that's why I was so attracted to the topic for this episode. I invite a friend who I've done quite a bit of theater with in this town, Mr. Aaron Linden. Aaron has been involved on stage and off stage in community theater for many years and has involved himself in the business side of things quite a bit. But beyond that, he also has an interesting side hustle that sends his voice all over the world. I'll let him explain once the episode starts. But we sat down for a great conversation about the less showy side of theater, the business side of things. After all, these artists are working for a living, and someone has to make sure money is flowing. So, we're going to look at a particular era in history when the business side of things was interesting, to say the least. So without further ado, here's my discussion with Aaron Linden about the history of actor managers. There's quite an anomaly here in that we are a faction of a very elite group in the Sheridan theater community.
Because we're both named Aaron?
We belong to the Aarons.
Years ago, growing up, I knew one guy named Aaron, and it was A-R-O-N.
Oh my God, what?
Who spells it like that, right?
A Klingon.
So I move here. And now I literally know.
Yeah.
Like 30 Aarons, boys, girls, whatever. Yep. To the point that we almost need to rename the town Sherrod Aaron.
Oh, I love it.
Right?
I love it.
I wanna make an Aaron group, make a reservation at a restaurant for 30 people, and just show up and be like, "We are Aaron."
And your name?
Aaron. Aaron. All of us. Don't screw up the drink order.
Well, okay. So there's you and me. There's your wife. Mm-hmm. There is another married pair of Aarons.
Yes.
There is Aaron Butler, who's been on the show. She's the executive director of the YO. There is a young director. Their name is Aaron Samantha Hansen. I mean, we have so many. It's ridiculous.
It's bizarre.
To the point where people just refer to us by our last names now.
100%.
I so love that.
100%. So, like, Butler at the YO Theater, right? She's like, "People call me Butler?" I'm like, "Yes." What are we supposed to say? Like, it's got to be that way. You can't not, because it's like, "Oh, well, I was talking to Aaron." Well, come on. I need a little more to go on.
Yeah. Oh, no, the female Aaron.
There's 10 of those. So it's like, no, you go Butler, Odom, Linden, Cranston,
yeah,
whatever.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Awesome. But Aaron, you are involved in so many different things as far as the community theater thing. And I think that's so cool, because that really speaks to, like, the foundation
of an arts community is that there are very dedicated people, and but your wife is right now directing A Little Night Music. They're in yes. rehearsals for that. You're the set builder.
Oh my God. Yeah.
But you've also served on boards. You are on the Civic Theater Board, Civic Theater Guild Board, which I am. That's our community theater. But you're also on the YO Theater Board right now. Mm-hmm. So you're really invested kind of in like the business side of things.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's something that on this show I have talked about to a degree, but the business side of things. It is called show business.
Yeah, 100%.
You know? Everybody's like, no, you get to go out and sing and dance and, you know, put on costumes. Like, yeah, well, somebody's got to figure out how to pay for all that and get people there.
100%.
And you have to pardon me. I am right at the end of a cold. You know, it's that day where it's like, ah, I'm feeling great. I've been feeling awful for several days, but all that built up stuff in your lungs and everything. It's like, hey, we're coming out now and it doesn't matter. Yeah. So
totally excited to sit in close proximity to you.
There, see, I sound like I've been chain smoking for 50 years, and I'm only 44. But you also, this is something that's interesting, you do freelance voice work.
I do.
Man. Well, tell me about that. What are some things you do?
So it's kind of crazy because I had not been on a stage until about 8 years ago. That was my first on-stage acting experience, but you put me behind a microphone with a script or, you know, an idea, and I would do it, you know, and I had accents, I had impressions, so people would hire me, and still do to this day on, you know, freelance sites, whatever. They're like, hey, we need a, you know, a German voice for Oktoberfest. Cool. I'm your guy. Yep. We need Irish for St. Patrick's Day. Fine. We need Schwarzenegger. Okay. Whatever. Mm-hmm. But I had never been on a stage, and it scared the hell out of me because you have to actually like memorize stuff, right?
And they can see me.
And so up until 8 years ago, I'd never been on a stage, and then I get on the stage, and then from then until now, probably been in like 15 productions, whatever, but really know the business side of things because I'm a business guy.
Yeah.
But what the hell was the question?
That's good.
do freelance stuff, do stuff for local radio. Mm-hmm. Especially Aaron and I, we do crazy, you know, commercials and whatever.
And that's your wife,
Aaron. Yeah. That's my wife, Aaron, not this Aaron, and it's really confusing.
Like, I wasn't there.
Right. And it's so funny because it gets to be almost kind of a joke. Mm-hmm. Patrick.
Okay, yeah.
Right. 4 years ago, we all did Into the Woods.
Yeah.
And he was having a hard time figuring out what the hell I actually do for a living. and one of the greatest moments was Pepto-Bismol commercial. And in it, it's upset stomach, indigestion, diarrhea.
Oh, yeah. That has been the funniest thing. Like, those actors... I just saw one the other day in a hockey game, and, you know, you had four people talking about, you know, upset stomach issues, and dancing, and then the last term is diarrhea.
Yeah, and so I told Patrick, I said, oh, I'm the diarrhea guy. And he's like, what? I go, yeah, every time that commercial plays, I make a nickel.
Yeah.
And that's what I do for a living. And he's like, what? I go, no, that's bullshit.
But, I mean, so you basically get freelance work contracted for, like, you know, maybe $30, do this spot, and then...
100%.
And then word gets around.
Yep.
Man.
And, okay. I mean, literally, it's like, hey, we need a 30-second commercial. Mm-hmm. Here's the script.
Yep.
Do it in this voice. $30, $50, whatever. And then they own it. Fine. I don't care.
Yeah.
To the point that, like, a gal that I know in... Iowa? I think she's in Iowa. Mm-hmm. Was like, I think I heard you on the radio.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what?
Yeah, you probably.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Because I don't know where these things play. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some that I did a specific one, Kranz and I did. It was like these two dogs talking back and forth for this groomer. And it plays in like Virginia Beach and somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay,
whatever. I guess.
Yeah.
Patrick and I actually, you know, he's been on the show before, Patrick Kossel. He and I filmed a commercial here at my house for a Walking Dead mobile game. And folks, if you want to see it, you can go to the Euripides Humanities Instagram page and see this great 15-second clip. I got covered in, like, you know, blood and brain matter to nice. Make it look like I beat zombies to death. It was a pretty fun gig, but I never heard of anybody ever seeing it because I think it played mainly in Asian markets.
Nice. So,
yeah, but it's like I got paid the one time for it. It was like, okay, see, that'll work.
That, you know, that's some crazy stuff too, because I've done a couple of ads, like TV ads, and I got to tell you, it kind of pisses me off. I go to YouTube, and I pull up a couple of different things. I'm huge into conspiracy theories, ghosts, UFOs, UAPs, whatever.
Okay.
Do a podcast actually weekly called Jackalopes Explore. Shameless plug. That's all about, you know, conspiracy theories, whatever. But so I go on and I pull up different channels to watch different things.
Yeah.
And this ad that I did plays all the time.
Nice.
No.
No.
It's so annoying.
Diarrhea.
Yeah. No, it's just I hit play and there I am walking down Main Street and I'm like, God dang, I don't want to see it.
I don't want to see it.
Anymore. I don't want to see it.
Yeah, that's the old me.
Yeah, yeah.
Check out my newer stuff. well, Lyndon, we are going to be talking today about how some other people were able to find work.
Okay.
In theater. And mainly, we're going to focus on how they got work in Europe, more specifically in Great Britain over the years.
Ooh.
So in the Middle Ages, when theater started to become more popular entertainment and getting out of the churches, theater would often be part of festivals or ritual celebrations as part of the church calendar.
Okay. Sure.
Guilds of tradesmen were responsible for certain plays due to their expertise. Here's a quote. The Last Supper, for example, might have been presented by the Baker's Guild because of the bread served by Christ.
Oh, nice.
The Noah play might be by the Shipbuilders Guild. And The Visit of the Magi, in which the three wise men bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the Christ child, would be presented by the Goldsmiths Guild.
Interesting.
Makes sense.
It totally makes sense.
I mean, in a way.
And it's kind of a shameless plug.
It, yeah. What is this story? It involves gold. Ooh, I know who to get.
Yeah. Get this guy. Get the goldsmith.
But as far as actors were concerned, they could be anybody. And were often amateurs. But since it was often considered religious duty, not only did the actors not get paid directly, they would often actually face financial loss when performing a play.
Who doesn't?
Gee, I've never seen that. Actors were expected to be at all rehearsals, and if they had to miss, they were often fined.
Really? God, that's a great idea.
I know. We gotta start doing that. On top of that, if a rehearsal conflicted with an actor's actual daily work, the actor would have to hire someone to fill in for them at the shop.
Wow.
So not only are you like,
you're like, oh, I'll pay or I get fined. Either way, I'm screwed.
Either way, yeah. Actors were often typecast and requested to play the same types of roles time after time. So, you know, if you're like a big burly guy, you're always Cain because they're like, oh, right. I can see him killing somebody.
Right.
Or if you're a pretty young woman, you're always the Virgin Mary. So, right.
It's still that way. Some things don't change.
You know, I saw it again this morning. It's been a topic on this show before, but can Seymour from Little Shop of Horrors be hot?
Mm.
Oh, okay. You can go back and listen to that whole episode. It was great. But the thing that's off Broadway right now is it's just basically been like, for this limited amount of weeks, this actor will be playing Audrey or this actor will be playing Seymour.
Sure.
And coming up is Corbin Blue, who is one of the handsome young men in High School Musical.
Right.
Playing Seymour.
Really?
And you're like, you're going to have to do some work to make him look nerdy.
Right.
The first one was Jeremy Jordan.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, he's too handsome.
Right, right, right. You're like, doesn't work.
I'd go see it.
But... Right. You can put as much tape on the glasses as you want. It's not going to make a difference.
So anyway, these actors are typecast. And you can see how this might be a difficult concept for an actor. On one hand, the actor is meeting expected religious duty and is seen well in the eyes of the public and the church. On the other hand, there's no personal profit unless the actor happens to benefit from the business of the guild to which the actor belongs.
Sure, sure.
Down the line, somebody might come into the bakery and buy some bread because you broke bread with the apostles.
Right.
But by the time of the Renaissance, due to some philosophical changes between medieval and Renaissance eras, the arts took more of a priority in people's lives rather than a religious requirement. People saw the arts as not just a cathartic purgation, but also as something that could be enjoyed and therefore was worth paying for.
Aha!
Aha! Now, on the European continent, traveling troops of actors would tour all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
One of the more popular forms of entertainment was commedia dell'arte. And as you might recall from prior episodes, commedia is largely an improvisational type of theater. A troupe of actors all play recognizable stock characters and have a large playbook of scenes they could act out, often conforming to the area in which they are playing to make the scenes more relevant to their audiences.
Totally.
They spoke mainly in gibberish language so that the art could cross language barriers. But, you know, it's all very similar things. Like, you know, a guy complaining that his wife complains too much or something like
right.
that. And then she comes in and she's, you know.
Complaining.
Yeah, and she's got a rolling pin and, you know, whatever. It's recognizable stuff, right? Now, the troops often worked in something of a profit-sharing program. So all actors would get paid more or less equally. The head of the troop might get a little bit more since he usually would be doing more work. But at least now actors are getting paid.
Right, finally.
However, since it was a more ensemble feel, no one actor stood out since each actor got to shine in different scenarios that would be performed. So, like, they'd go to this area and it might be around a university. So they'd do the scene that involved the snobbish professor or something like that.
Sure.
Or, you know, they'd go to near a military base and the capitano would be the coward or something like that. Pretty fun stuff.
Right.
And, you know, they'd just get paid like crazy, but nobody really stood out. This was not necessarily the case in England. During the British Renaissance, things got a little more convoluted for a great number of political reasons. Elizabeth I began regulating theatrical practices in the 1570s, which put a great number of limits on exactly who could practice theater and when. For example, for a company to be granted a license, it would have to have a sponsor from nobility no lower than the rank of a baron.
Really?
Yeah. You'd have to have that major sponsor in place.
You got to get like the wax seal on your license.
The guy with the ring.
Yeah.
And that sponsor would be responsible for the general expenses, but would also receive a corresponding amount of profit. However, if a company was able to get a license, there were three classes of people besides the sponsor who could benefit. First, you have your shareholders.
Ah.
Well, it's just the title. It's not like today where if they're making something on the stage, they're like, well, we've got to please the shareholders.
Right.
No. This is what this means. If they wanted to make more profit, these shareholders, they'd have to be involved in the company, they'd have to invest a certain amount of their own money into the company, and would receive percentage of the remaining profits based on their level of investment. So you'd have to not only buy into the company, you'd have to perform something for the company.
Right.
Be an actor, be a costume designer, something like that.
Build a set.
Yes. Well, not so much in British Renaissance, but yes. And like I said, these included major actors in the company.
Right.
So you'd have to have your own money to invest in the company if you wanted to get anything back from it.
It's been a sham from the beginning,
right?
Really,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. The next class is hirelings.
Ooh.
These are just like individual actors who are paid a basic stipend to play smaller parts. So we have three guys who need to hold spears near that door. Okay, you're all getting
a shilling.
Yeah, exactly. And then there were apprentices. Theater makers who were just getting started, didn't get paid, but were compensated in housing and food for the company for specific productions.
Sure.
So, okay, you got your shareholders, your hirelings, and your apprentices. However, lots of little traveling troops would go around the country in England with some illegitimate licenses and would get paid whatever they could, doing their best to avoid the eyes of the government.
Again, some things never change.
Right. How do we get around this? So this more or less was a practice in England until theater practice was banned during the years that the Puritans removed the monarchy. Again, if you want to, you can go back and listen to my pilot episode, The Consequences of the Interregnum, to find out what really happened there. But in 1660, when Charles II was restored to the throne, he reestablished theater practice by declaring that only two companies could be in existence to begin his cultural overhaul. And he just granted them patents without Parliament's say-so.
Wow.
Yeah. He just wanted to get things going again. Because it was just dull and gray and lifeless. And
right.
He was not lifeless.
Right. No.
Now, under these new laws, acting companies got away from the profit-sharing plans that had dominated the Renaissance, and they established a contract system. So under this, actors were hired for a specific period of time for a specific company. One of the
sure.
two. But this was only practiced in London. As the numbers of theater grew throughout the rest of England, most were still operating on the sharing plan system. So, you know, you'd have people buy in or, you know, they'd just figure out how to spread things out equally instead of, okay, you were contracted to play this part for 20 shillings for the next 7 weeks or something
right.
like that, right?
Right.
However, back in London, the companies were generally managed by one person known as the manager.
Oh.
This manager would frequently be the lead actor of the company who would most often get the lead roles. And this is who we're going to be talking about today, the
right.
actor manager.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
20 minutes in, and we finally get to the title card.
That's all right.
Yep. But at this time, we do see a great number of people getting the entrepreneurial spirit and investing in theater by being part owners of the buildings or companies. So they don't really have much to contribute, but money.
Right.
So they're there, and it's a lot like you have investors who are like oil barons or steel tycoons or something today who have nothing to do with theater. But I can't remember when I said it was on this show sometime that what do you get when you have more money than God?
Sure. Yeah.
You go buy an award, basically.
Right.
You know, we've got Oscar season Oscar time right around the corner. And there's going to be people who walk away with an Oscar that have had nothing to do with the creative process.
Right.
They just wanted their name on it.
They just backed it.
Yep. Exactly. Now, with all this business at the forefront of theater practice, many actors actually got out of the business side of things. It just became too convoluted, and they couldn't get anywhere because it was just the one guy at the top.
Right.
So they just kind of became members of the companies and, you know, operated under the contract system. This greatly reduced their power in the companies, obviously.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So they had no say in what shows were going to be done or anything like that. They were basically at the whim of the heads of the companies now.
Mm-hmm.
And this actor-manager system dominated the British stage throughout the 18th and 19th centuries.
I would argue it probably still does today.
But it also must be considered, as I've said in many episodes before, that actors were not held in high esteem at this time, even though the government had made acting a legal occupation since the Renaissance. It took an act of government to be like, yes, actors are legitimate.
Well, it's one of my favorite things is on commercials to this day. It says real people, not actors. Like, actors aren't real people. So, well, you're legitimate now. It's a way to make a living. The government deems it so. What?
I can see that, though, because, look, real people, not actors. I legitimately had hemorrhoids for 17 months.
Right.
And then I took Flurfenfluff. And
yeah.
That was my real experience.
Yeah. Okay. Real people.
Real people.
Not actors. Because actors are not real people.
Oh. And,
disclaimer.
Yes. Speaking of actors not really being real people or legitimate performers or occupations.
Right.
Even though women were allowed to be professional actors as of the Restoration beginning in 1660, one source I saw compared them directly to prostitutes on the scale of social
100%.
And my women numbers just dropped. I'm seeing it right now in real time.
No, but I mean, you know, you're being paid to perform a service. Oh. So, I mean, like, I see where maybe their thought process, even though it's not at all the same thing.
No. There was also, you know, when you do a play, you're doing things that you don't normally do in regular life.
Right.
You know, if you're doing a play about the foibles of the upper class and their sexual exploits, you know, you're inviting things and people are seeing you doing it. So they're like,
you know, it's funny because you and my wife did a show.
Yeah.
Together.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because every weekend we would spend
hours doing tattoos with a Sharpie, right?
Oh, right.
Right? So she was heavily tattooed and all this stuff. And then, like, a week would go by, and they'd wash off, you know, after time, whatever. And people would be like, well, you don't have tattoos? Just because she had them on stage, everyone was like, oh, you're horrible. You have tattoos. You were swearing. You smoked, whatever. Oh. And so people, you play this part, and people believe that that's who you are and what you look like. Right. It's not.
No.
Not even close. No. Anthony Hopkins isn't a cannibal.
Yeah, he didn't go out and eat somebody's face.
Maybe he did. Maybe he's a method actor. I don't know.
No. I mean, I've hinted on method on the show several times. He's not one.
Okay.
But, God. Now, plus, due to a great number of political, social, and economical factors, to further regulate theater practice, Parliament passed the Licensing Act of 1737, which I've talked about on previous episodes. Overall, what this did was grant the role of Lord Chamberlain, who oversaw a ton of things, gave that person utter control of what could be seen on stage, putting an end to a lot more of the risky material out there. Mm. Many classics were still approved, but oftentimes, over the next several decades, more of the prurient content was removed or replaced.
So he was the original censor.
Oh, he was one of them. Yes. I mean, censorship has existed in so many different ways over the years.
Right.
But, oh, this period in British history, if you want to get a bigger picture of it, you can go back and listen to my episodes on Joe Orton, who's this great playwright who was writing these great plays about gay lifestyles in London in the 1960s when it was still illegal.
Right.
And then in 1968, I think that was 1968, the censorship law was repealed completely. And it's like, you can say whatever you want to on British stages anymore. He had been killed like the few years earlier.
No kidding.
Yeah. So,
wow.
Like, what would we have seen from this guy? I mean, because the stuff he was writing was very, very dense and dark and darkly comedic.
Right.
But he didn't get a chance to just let it all go. Anyway. So back to the Licensing Act of 1737. It also only allowed for two companies to be licensed to produce, air quotes, legitimate drama.
Oh.
Oh, yes. These two were the Theatre Royal, Covent Garden, and the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane. We've probably heard of those. And here's the final nail in this Licensing Act coffin. Only licensed theatres could charge admission for patrons to see legitimate drama. So other theater companies could be in existence. They just couldn't charge ticket prices. Specifically for, quote, tragedy, comedy, opera, play, farce, or other entertainment of the stage for gain, hire, or reward.
Really? Uh-huh. Interesting.
As I was reading it, this licensing act was mainly, it was a big reaction to a play called, I want to say it was called The Golden Rump. Which was referring to the Rump Parliament.
Yes.
Which didn't do anything. And so they were, you know, but there were still some members of that parliament remaining. And so they're like, you know what I don't like? Being criticized with the theater.
We're going to delegitimize you.
Delegitimize. We have two places that can do theater, and they will be approved by this gentleman only.
Right.
And we're going to make some of them happier than they were. Oh, my God. But some clever managers tried to get around this.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I love this. One claimed that theatrical performance was a free addition between different acts of music concerts.
Oh.
You're coming to pay for the music.
Right.
We just have some theater that you're not paying for.
It's just the intermission.
It's just the intermission while we tune our instruments and get set up. Right. And they've got to take a break. Oh, this is great. Another claimed that the performance of a play was free at his theater, but the patron must buy a cup of hot chocolate.
Love it. Love it. Two drink minimum.
Enjoy. Yes. I got into one of those in Vegas once.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was like, we're walking around. They're like, hey, free comedy show. We're like, really? And I look at it, and it was a ventriloquist I'd heard of.
Sure.
And I'm like, oh, my God, this is a free show? And we go in, we sit down, and they have the opener. And then they're like, all right, 30 minutes for your two drink minimum.
Right.
And
$25 a piece.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Still got to see that guy. It was pretty cool. Now, let's put this all in perspective. Only two places in London can do legitimate theater. You have an absolute air of censorship over theater so that more risky pieces cannot be done. You have actors in control of companies, and they will often play the lead roles. Aaron, can you imagine what might have happened to the quality and content of shows from then on?
Oh, man.
Like, do you have any guess where this is going as far as the type of stuff you'd go see if you went to see theater?
Boring. Boring shit. You're censored. You got the guys in charge placating to the two companies, basically, that can do this. Mm-hmm. It's going to be whatever they, them, the people licensing this deem appropriate.
The Illuminati.
The New World Order. I would imagine that it would be insanely boring.
Oh, well, check this out. Acting practices for the first half of the 18th century became well known for being overblown and bombastic.
What?
All pointing to the lead actor being given the most opportunities to chew the scenery. This is the metaphor that I came up with. It's kind of like if you were only able to perform Hallmark Channel Christmas movie scripts over and over and overacted every part.
Which they are.
What do you mean? Santa didn't get you my letter. No, I got it. Oh! Oh, my God! Oh, I won't be lonely at Christmas!
The woodcutter is trapped in the cabin with the love of his life.
I won't take your innocence.
Or will I? Yeah. Wow. Oh, man.
That's, yeah.
And you have to pay for this crap.
Yes.
Okay, there's a part of me that would love to see any of this on stage at least once. But this is the way it was. It was the beginning of the star system, even though most people didn't want to be seen with theater people. Quite the dichotomous time. But while we're at a good halfway point, I want to encourage you to rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening. From what I understand, that's what spurs the algorithms to get this show to more and more listeners. Also, go check out the Instagram feeds for both Euripides, Eumenides, and Trident Theater. Leave some commentary on our photos and reels. They might just be discussed in upcoming episodes. But let's get back to this one. Time to continue the discussion with Aaron Linden about actor managers. But it wasn't like that forever. In 1747, actor David Garrick became the actor manager at Drury Lane and became well known for his devotion to the overall production of plays. In many ways, historians consider him to be something of one of the first directors, even though it wasn't called a director, in that he took almost total control of everything that went on stage. He demanded something of a more realistic performing style as opposed to the very showy style that the period had become known for, right? Garrick demanded a lot of the actors in his company, too. He called for a longer rehearsal process than most of the other companies.
Sure.
They usually only performed, like, in the medieval days, it was, like, a couple days. In this period, maybe a couple weeks. He's like, nope, we need 6 weeks. And what would they do with that? Mainly, he wanted his actors to tell a more true story through research and speculation of the script. Like, nice. He actually put him to it.
Sure.
He even devised a method of finding his actors who couldn't make it to rehearsal on time. Bring that back! What resulted from this attention to detail was an acting style that became something of the precursor to modern acting, a style we practice today, although it didn't really take hold completely until closer to the 20th century. What also resulted from this was that Garrick was considered snobbish and swaggering by some of his colleagues, his compatriots.
Of course.
However, his efforts as a writer also earned him a lot of respect in literary circles. When Garrick died in 1779, he was buried in Westminster Abbey in the Poets' Corner.
Really?
Yep.
How cool.
Because they respected him so much as a writer.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But was he ever known as the Muffin Man? Because he was on Drury Lane.
I bring up Drury Lane, somebody's like, dude, do they know that? I got to do this. Before I get into the 19th century actor managers, I do have to spend some time on Garrick's predecessor at Drury Lane, Colley Cibber. I looked at that.
Sibber.
Yeah, never heard of him, but there he is. Oh, like that picture.
How fantastic.
Mm, yes.
Love the powdered wig. I think we should bring those back.
Oh my God. Just why not? Colley Cibber came to prominence as an actor in the late 1600s, mostly gaining fame for playing fops and other comedic leads.
Oh.
So the picture you just saw. I can't remember. I think I looked it up. I think his, that character's name was something like Lord Foppingen.
Mm.
You're like, no kidding.
Yeah, right.
And although he demanded he could play tragic characters just as well, audiences didn't have any of it. They wanted him funny. Cibber also became a pronounced playwright with many works to his name that were often performed during his time. But it was his business practice and slippery social life that he became best known for.
Ooh.
So basically, like, he turned into one of these fops in his real life.
Right.
Just like, I know people, I know this person, and they might not be as talented, but they got this stuff done.
Sure.
You've never heard of that. With two other actors, Cibber was able to buy the patent for the Queen's Theatre at Haymarket. But soon into the run, Cibber had a falling out with one of his partners, who then left the group. But the theater was doing well, and when manager Christopher Rich could no longer manage Drury Lane, through legitimate means or not, Cibber was able to buy that patent and thus become the manager of Drury Lane.
Oh, man.
And everybody's like, was that... Did anybody, was anybody else in the room when that happened?
Exactly.
So many will also criticize his legitimacy in being named Poet Laureate,
oh,
as there's plenty of evidence to suggest that they were better and more deserving poets than Cibber. He just knew the right people.
And it carries through to today.
Right? Now, throughout the 18th century and into the 19th century, several more patents for theaters were granted. So there were several more companies that were allowed to do legitimate
theater. Yes.
And as usual, the plays performed were a mixture of classics like Shakespeare, albeit often edited heavily.
Sure, of course.
Let's see. There was the new genre of melodramas that was starting to come out, and any other sort of play that could pass the censorship of Lord Chamberlain. In the early 19th century, the Industrial Revolution saw the populations of cities grow exponentially,
mm-hmm.
and something of a new working middle class emerged. This was unexpected for theater at the time. It was a lot like everything else in London. You had your rich and you had your poor. There was nothing in the middle.
Nothing in the middle.
Right. So now you have this middle class. It's like, hey, we're actually a huge part of the population now, and we would like a little bit of, you know, say in our government. So several acts were passed through Parliament in the first few decades of the 19th century to allow for the middle class to have more voting power, since they represented a bigger part of the population. For theater, this led to the passing of the Theatres Act of 1843, thus ending the grip that only patent-holding theaters had on the business.
Wow.
Right?
Theater revolution.
Yeah, no idea. Like, just these working-class people came out of the woodwork.
Right.
They passed this act and get more voting power, and then they're like, oh, wait, we shouldn't just have rich people in charge of things.
Weird.
Weird. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest oppositions to the passing of this act was the expected tidal waves of new theater buildings that would be built. Oh,
how dare you.
Dens of vice. But so many illegitimate theaters had already started and they were still operational that this new tidal wave of buildings never happened.
Huh.
So what they were afraid of, they were just like, it was just completely made up. These illegitimate theaters could just now do legitimate theater.
Which I love, illegitimate theater. Like,
I know, right? I,
if I ever started a theater company, I think that's what I would call
there
it.
There we go, illegitimate theater company.
Yeah.
So, what this actually led to was a flourishing era for actor managers, because there are so many companies now.
Sure.
If they couldn't get into a well-known company, they'd just start one of their own.
Right.
And see how they did. Now that most of the requirements to start a theater have been stripped away, anyone could throw their hats in the ring. I love
wow.
it. Free market.
Right, exactly.
Would you like to meet some of the more well-known actor managers of the 19th century, Aaron?
Absolutely.
So I'll let you meet a few and describe their contributions as we know it today. William MacCready.
Oh, yes. William MacCready.
MacCready. MacCready's made an appearance on a prior episode of this show, but I'll get into that later. MacCready spent most of his career as an actor, known for building a lot on the developments of David Garrick, developing a more realistic acting style, and for restoring the works of Shakespeare a lot closer to their original versions. Not that I'll go into that too much here, but between the Restoration and the middle of the 19th century, we go through the Romantic movement.
Mm, yes.
In theater, there was a lot of emphasis on virtue being able to overcome vice, which really didn't play too well with a lot of Shakespeare's works. So you'd see things like Hamlet and his uncle reconciling, and Romeo and Juliet awakening to get married. It was a little overzealous.
Yeah, sometimes. No.
But back to MacReady. As an actor, he performed many times for both Drury Lane and Covent Garden. His performances were noted for their attention to reality. He was even credited for something known as the MacReady pause, in which, while playing a part, he would pause in a line as though thinking about something, like people do. This didn't happen before that.
Really? What? There was no pregnant pause ever in acting?
To be or not to be, that is the question. Well, this is nobler.
Whoa! What? Huh. Wow.
That's brilliant. I want to see more of that.
I'm using the MacReady pause from now on.
Were you just thinking about something? Yeah. My God. But for a time, MacReady served as the actor manager at both Covent Garden and Drury Lane and sought to impose his acting discoveries on the companies there to just about equal successes and failures. So worked out kind of.
Right.
But at the same time, he was spearheading something. He was onto something. As a financial manager, he didn't do so hot, mainly due to his insistence that drama not be played at either theater more than 4 days a week. I mean, you don't want to get too down.
Yeah, well, you know. Drama. Let's do a rom-com.
I'd rather see something with fairies and wood nymphs. Now, MacReady stepped down from leadership only a couple years into his tenure and continued acting in various companies for many years. If you're still wondering, when we talked about MacReady on this program, he was one of the two actors in episode 8, The Incident at Astor Place, in which his rivalry with American actor Edwin Forrest resulted in a street riot in New York involving 15,000 rioters and several deaths.
What?
Yeah.
What?
I'll just challenge everybody to go back and listen to that one, but basically they both were playing, pardon the phrase, Macbeth, in New York on the same night, and it was this huge, like, American anti-British sentiment thing.
Sure.
So when MacReady comes in, Edwin Forrest was like a big, tough guy, you know, he's kind of the Jason Momoa of the day, but, you know, and not that Jason's not, but he was like a really good actor.
Right.
And so Americans were like, that's my Macbeth. That's my Macbeth. And so when MacReady comes over with his more genteel, kind of soft-spoken and pausing.
Yes. Thinking, like, contemplating.
Boo! You ain't the Macbeth I want! You know?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so, yeah.
Theater riots, though. Theater, I mean, like...
riots. There were so many of those, Aaron. I'm not even kidding.
That's insane.
Yeah. MacReady retired from acting in 1851, and spent the rest of his life tending to his family.
Nice.
Madame Vestris. Ooh, behave. Lucia Elizabeth Bartolozzi was born in London in 1797. The family moved around a bit when she was younger, as her father was a successful art dealer. From a young age, Lucia had been known for her singing talent, particularly her lower vocal range. I think somebody said she was a contralto at some point.
Hmm.
She studied singing and dance as a youngster and a teen. But at the age of 16, she married a handsome French ballet dancer, Auguste Armand Vestris. He would leave her 4 years into their marriage for an actress he met in Naples.
Ah, yes.
Cool guy.
Actresses from Naples.
I know.
I mean, who hasn't tried?
Dip in that pool. But Lucia was not held down by her man. Throughout the early years of her career, she performed in operas in both London and Paris, and that, you know, her reputation in London caused her to get to Paris.
Sure, yeah, all right.
So she, for several years, went back and forth between London and Paris just singing.
Amazing. Like
at age 20.
I can't even imagine.
No.
Especially back then.
Yeah. However, in 1820, she was contracted to play Don Giovanni himself as a breeches role, which, as you might recall, is when the women play the men, as her contralto voice added quite a bit of satire to the character.
Funny.
So for a woman, she's singing low, but as a man, she's really high.
Right.
And from then on, she played a lot of breeches roles, much to her financial success, but not so much her social standing.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Now, remember that breeches roles allowed women to wear leggings on stage in order to play men. So women gained fame for their notoriety and being able to show their form.
Right. Which is funny because you go back and you're like, women were playing men wearing leggings.
Yes.
But now if you wear leggings as a man, you'd be like, well,
yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, what? How times have changed.
Heels were men's fashion for hundreds of years.
Yes.
You know, I mean, just the taller heel on the boot.
Yeah, anyway. As were powdered wigs.
Makeup. In any case, by 1830, Madame Vestris, as she came to be known, continuing to carry her former husband's last name. Oh, she did actually get married again. And it was just, you know, he supported her, you know, but she was off to the races.
And by that time, when you're off to the races, you got to keep the name.
Now, she acquired the patent and ownership of the Olympic Theater, where she began showing burlesques and musical extravaganzas. Illegitimate theater, indeed.
Oh, my gracious.
But I do have to stress that burlesques were not like the burlesques we know today.
Oh, okay.
In that time, there were very satirical shows.
They showed ankle? No,
it could happen. But they were really more like parodies of other shows that were going on or of current events or political stuff at the time. And much to the dismay of her haters, she did quite well. Regular listeners may recognize her as the mentor to Laura Keene, one of my favorite characters on this program. Laura was an American visionary producer, but is unfortunately best known for being the one who held President Lincoln's head in her lap after he had been shot at her benefit night of Our American Cousin.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But she did so much. She like created the matinee. She created the American Touring Company and the extended run. But no, we just remember her because...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Lincoln.
Yeah. But more to Madame Vestris's credit, being an actor manager and owner of her own company, one of her most significant contributions was her devotion to sparing no expense when it came to the design aspects of her shows. Mm. She was known for demanding absolute attention to detail in costuming. She was also known to apply actual elements to her set designs, whether they were functional or not. So, for example, she would have doorknobs affixed to sets, even if they weren't to actually open doors. Because before that, they were just like painted flats. You know, we'd paint a door and we'd paint a doorknob. She said, nope, make that look like a door, put a doorknob in it. It's not going to open. It doesn't matter. It needs to look like it. She's also credited to be the first manager to use the box set on a British stage, which is like putting a room on a stage with a closed ceiling and removing one wall. That's that fourth wall thing.
You're right. Exactly.
So you're looking into somebody's actual reality.
How interesting.
Yep.
And again, this didn't exist until that point.
No.
Like, nobody thought of this.
No. Actually, it was kind of funny in my research. David Garrick, who was operating like 50 years before her or so, was the one who finally removed actual spectators from the stage. Because from the restoration on, you might be able to buy seats on the stage.
On the stage,
because
right.
you want to be seen. Hello, here's me with my little strumpet Look that I have this week. Look at me. I'm near the actors. And he's like, no, we need to get rid of those because you don't have people watching you in your daily life.
Or do you?
Maybe. Okay, and I'll hit on one more here real quick. Henry Irving.
Okay.
Now, Henry Irving has also had a full episode of this show, but his contributions as an actor manager for the Lyceum Theater were pretty impressive. Irving carried on the work of MacReady and Vestris in that he demanded more realistic acting and set design techniques. However, he did fall into the trap of allowing the Lyceum to have a repertoire that only really showcased his acting. And as I've said before, some of these plays weren't really that great, but gave the lead actor the opportunity to show off his acting talent more than anybody else's.
Right.
Oh, and he's the one who established, in Britain anyway, the convention of dimming the house lights to signal to the audience that a performance was about to begin.
Again, these things didn't exist before. Like, it's mind-blowing.
Well, you got to think, like, it was all gaslight for a while.
I suppose.
Or candlelight even.
Right.
You know, so you can't really dim candles.
No.
So you can extinguish a few and then bring them back out later. But yeah, you know.
Interesting. Yeah.
So what happened to all these actor managers? Well, as I mentioned before, the end of the 19th century was really the heyday for the actor manager. Since they could bring theater anywhere for profit, many troupes toured all over Britain. Sundays were often known as train days, when actors and other theater artists would gather at train stations to get ready to move to the next town. They were so prolific. It was just, it's train day. Yes.
Oh, God, avoid the train stations from the actors.
It's full of actors.
Ew.
However, when corporations began getting involved with theater practice, it became less about the one person at the top of the pyramid, but what was best for the bottom line of the company.
Mm.
So today, you have things like the Nederlander Corporation and the Schubert Organization, right? Plus, realistic and naturalistic acting practices were becoming more and more popular all over the West, which led to ensemble acting being appreciated over spotlighting one star.
Sure.
That's not to say efforts haven't been made, but the way of the actor-manager just doesn't seem to fit today's model of theater, as well as it did back then. I mean, years ago, when Trevor Nunn announced that he'd be stepping down as the director of the National Theatre in London, Sir Ian McKellen was asked at a lecture if he'd be interested in taking the job. Quote, he revealed that he'd been asked if he was interested in the job, but said no, because he couldn't face the exhausting prospect of spending all day in an office, running an enormous building, only to have to then go out and perform every night.
Oh, 100%.
Right. And Aaron, for what it's worth, that's the story of the actor manager.
I love that. That's fantastic.
You hear it a lot anymore. You've got a lot of people out there who are concerned about where their kids might be reading in schools and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to, you know, really crack down on it. But I'm like, look, they're probably going to go out and get the stuff somewhere anyway.
Well, isn't that the thing, though? Like, I mean, you know, it's like, it's anything. You try and control it. They're going to, if they want to find it, they will.
They will find it.
100%.
Yeah.
And especially in today's world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You can pull it up on your phone.
Right.
I mean, right? I mean, no, Johnny, you can't read about that. Really? Watch me.
Just did. Yeah, I downloaded it.
Right. Exactly.
So I don't know. I mean, I appreciate the era of the actor manager to a degree because it did move things along.
Well, that's the thing. It progressed things, right? I mean, it helped build it to what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And without that, where would we be?
Right.
So.
Right. I mean, today you can kind of equate it to big movie stars starting their own production companies.
Mm-hmm.
Like the one that came to mind right away was Tom Cruise.
Well, and they do.
Yeah.
I mean, you see all of these big films, and if you pay attention, executive producer, right? Like, it's like, okay.
Sure, sure you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm also the star.
Right. I funded the movie to be in the movie to make money from the movie.
Right.
So really, we haven't moved that far past.
No, in that case. But I also think of it like the movies didn't have a huge impact on this. I mean, they kind of killed the actor manager too, because now people could go get new content from people that didn't have to travel to get there. So theater was the performing art.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of the 19th century, it was huge. It was a huge business. And this is something that I didn't even include in this. By the end of the 19th century, actors started to become legitimized. Like, people started to look at them as not whores and thieves.
Right, you know? Right.
Henry Irving was the first actor to be knighted.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then there were, like, three other actor managers who were knighted as well. And I think people just went, oh, well, they're okay.
Yeah, well, they're real people, not actors.
You mean Othello didn't really kill Desdemona?
My God. He's not a murderer?
She showed up at the end of the play. She bowed.
Right, exactly. So funny, though.
Yeah.
So funny how people, I guess that's, you've done a good job, right? If people believe it that much.
Right.
That you're that person.
Yeah.
We did a show years ago, And it was outside Mullingar. Mm-hmm. Heavy Irish accent for, my God, 90 minutes, 100 minutes.
No, wait, are you going to tell me that you saw people in Community later that were surprised you weren't Irish?
We are at at a big coffee joint that I won't mention.
That's okay.
Starbucks.
I'm not sponsored.
And yeah, and we're in line, and these people behind us, you know, I'm like, oh, I'll have, you know, a double calf, no cup, double sleeve, something.
And especially upside down. When you order like that.
Oh, yes. and these people went, oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yes. They're like, oh, we saw you in the show. You're not Irish?
Nope.
Ain't not even kinda. You know, like. But it's so funny because, yeah. And that happened several times,
mm-hmm.
to the point that we would just go places sometimes and totally talk like that, you know, just talk, keep up appearance. And it was so funny because mm-hmm. people, if they're believing that, then I guess, yeah, you've done that job.
I think it was years ago. I was at a Wyo Rodeo street dance and I was with an actor friend and we were like, why don't we be Irish for the night?
Oh, perfect.
You know?
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a foot in the door
to talk to
several young, under the influence women. Like, oh my God, are you really from Ireland?
Oh yeah.
1,000%.
Oh, 100.
Right up your fucking arse.
Oh yeah, right. Right. Yeah. And that's an actory thing, though, too, isn't it? Like, you just go places and you're like, hey, fuck it. Let's do this tonight. You know, like, we're going to be British, you know, like, yeah.
I like to do that to scam callers anymore when they call in.
Oh.
I'm here to talk to you about your extended warranty. Get out of the car.
Yeah, right.
Get out of the phone.
It's come on. Hurry. There's a bomb in there. Let's go. Come on.
Yeah. And that's when the guy on the other end of the line goes, okay, I'll drop the act.
Right, right. Or he just hangs up.
Listen, I'm just an actor trying to get through.
This is that day job I don't mind missing. Job. Yeah.
Perhaps this discussion should continue. Is there a benefit to the actor-manager system today? On one hand, an actor is, for lack of a better term, in the spotlight night after night and understands what pleases an audience and what doesn't. On the other hand, I think we all have heard the reputation that actors can develop monstrous egos and would only be interested in showcasing themselves. It certainly does still happen today. In any case, I want to thank Aaron Linden for his contributions to this episode, and who knows, it's very possible you've heard him on some commercial before, wherever you are. And with that, this actor manager is signing off. This has been another episode of Euripides Amenities, a theater history podcast. Another episode will be in your ears in a couple weeks, and I'll see you at intermission.